Skyline is introducing a new chicken chili. Come get that world-famous Skyline flavor you love with a new protein option. Try the new Skyline Chicken Chili on Waze, Coney's, and all your Skyline favorites. At Columbus Skyline locations only, while supplies last.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Focus Group podcast. I'm Sarah Longwell, publisher of The Bulwark, and this week we are going to crawl into one of the most uncomfortable places in American politics, the gap between what the Republican base voters demand and what swing voters will tolerate. I talk about this all the time as one of my fundamental truisms about the current state of the Republican Party, which is that the gap between what base voters want and what swing voters will tolerate has gotten very large. And since Donald Trump's conviction on 34 felony counts, many of his most energetic supporters among elected Republicans have condemned the entire justice system as rigged, politically motivated, banana republic-esque. You get the idea, because that is what their voters demand. It turns out, though, that swing voters don't all like Republicans behaving this way. So we're going to get some reactions from both of these kinds of groups today, because these tensions within the Republican Party are important, critical to understanding the current election and whatever happens to the GOP if Trump loses. My guest today is Isaac Arnsdorf, national political reporter for The Washington Post and author of the new book, Finish What We Started, The MAGA Movement's Ground War to End Democracy. Isaac, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Sarah.
My producer told me that he has to read every single book for these, and he says yours was one of the best ones he's ever had to read. I skimmed it. I have so many podcasts to do, you know?
You gave it a DC read. You read the parts about you.
I did. Okay, so as far as we know, I think you are the first guest on this podcast to appear here and also on Steve Bannon's War Room. You did that like in the course of rolling out your book, which I love. So tell us what reporting your book taught you about Trump's takeover of the grassroots Republican Party, especially the precinct strategy, which I followed very closely back in, 2021, 2022.
Yeah, absolutely. So the book really starts after January 6th and focuses on the period where Trump was not only out of power, but kind of out of the picture, right? Like in those early months of 2021, he was kind of in political hibernation for a while. And it was not at all inevitable that he would have this comeback and overwhelmingly become the Republican nominee again. And the reason why that happened was actually a bottom-up phenomenon. To a large extent, the mechanism for that was this precinct strategy, which was popularized by Steve Bannon, but implemented by the movement, by the grassroots. The idea being that Republicans were responsible for selling out Trump when everything was on the line, meaning not going along with his efforts to keep himself in power after losing the election. And there's a lot of truth in that, actually, that if you look at the pressure points and the reasons why Trump failed, it was really a handful of Republicans who refused to cooperate. And so the idea was that the movement needed to purge the party of people like that and get rid of all those Republicans so that would never happen again. And it's called the precinct strategy because that started at the lowest rung of the party ladder, the precincts, and from there worked up to the districts and the counties and the states. And eventually, this actually happened after I finished the book, but it resulted in the change that we saw at the very top of the party pyramid at the RNC.
When you were doing this reporting, were a lot of these folks sort of traditional Republicans, like into the party, or were they people who are like, no, Trump gave me life, political life?
Well, I mean, there's also a group of people who I think were kind of traditional rank and file Republicans who became MAGA Republicans, right?
Totally.
So it was the process of both bringing in more radical voters who were marginalized by the traditional Republican Party and Trump welcoming them into the fold, but also by the process of the way that Trump talks and all the things that he and his movement have lived through over the past 8 years of radicalizing the existing rank and file and just kind of mainstreaming that extremism to the point that that's the party consensus now.
You know, you're 100% right. The existing Republican Party elected Trump, he became their nominee. And now part of that was a big fractured field, but he was offering something that not only did the Republican base want, but the Republican base Charlie Sykes used to have this formulation. I'm sure he still does. Hey, Charlie. That there was always this like recessive gene in the Republican Party that was kind of the Sarah Palin,
Pat Buchanan
gene that is now the dominant gene. And Trump sort of helped it go dominant, but it was always there. And so Trump helped to sort of grow it. But I wouldn't want to act like it wasn't there to begin with, and Trump kind of met the moment and had a built-in audience, because I think that's true. So let's listen to some of these voters, these people who basically say, I identify more with Trump than I do with the Republican Party, and we ask them why. Here's what they said.
And I think the biggest problem I have is that the Republican Party is happy with losing. They lose on all the issues, and they justify it in whatever way that they do, and they say that they're happy. So you know what? Unfortunately, I can't back someone that's a loser all the time. I find them to be very spineless and very two-faced. When you mentioned who do you think of is at that top of that list, I'd say Ronna McDaniel. Okay. You know, she's not ever been for our interest. She's lost every election that we've been in. And she's just looking for her next job, whether she's going to either be a lobbyist or she's going to go work as a commentator for CNN or MSNBC. So that's not who we stand for.
I think that there's been some people in there that need to go. We need new people in with new ideas that are for the people. They seem to tend to focus on what will advance themselves personally. And I just think we need a whole new structure. It's almost like you got two frats at one school, you know, that are for the same thing, but they're rivalry against each other. And it seems like it's for themselves and the people that have those seats and not the common people.
I mean, I'm old enough to remember the days of Ronald Reagan and the Republican Party of that era. And it just doesn't seem as cohesive. It doesn't seem as one-minded, right-minded, I guess you want to say. I get the feeling that there are too many people that are trying to jockey for positions to get to the next level. You know, I still don't quite get what Nikki Haley did and why she did it for so long, but she is but one example.
I see like a Laura Boebert, you know, Matt Gaetz to a certain extent, but Marjorie Taylor Greene as well. It's almost kind of like they're the right-wing version of the squad from the Democrats, but they're just trying to do things to get likes and just kind of promote themselves.
I think it's the Marjorie Taylor Greens and the Matt Gaetzes that are the firebrands who have the actual backbone, whether you agree with them or not. They're actually coming out making a statement to go in and say, this is what we stand for.
I'm just getting disappointed that a lot of them aren't even backing Trump anymore. I think they're so afraid of how they're going to be viewed. They don't even want to back him. And they're kind of all over. Some are just very conservative. Some are middle of the road. Some are going along with what all the Democrats are saying.
So that was like a smattering. And it's interesting because there's a couple things mixed in there. There are the people who are like, I want the fighters, right? I want Marjorie Taylor Greene. I want Lauren Boebert. And when people are talking about the fracturing in the party, they often mean like, I'm mad Mitt Romney won't support Donald Trump. But then there's other people. They actually think that the Marjorie Taylor Greens or the Matt Gaetzes are like more absurd than Donald Trump. They're like, they're trying to get likes and create things. So like, tell me how, when you're out there talking to people, what did you hear from people in terms of how they felt about the Republican Party?
Well, I mean, part of what's interesting about this conversation also is it reminds me of how like even Trump himself is not necessarily immune to some of those conversations. Like there were instances with certain endorsements in the midterms where there was like a sense that like this wasn't a real Trump endorsement. Some kind of like intangible authenticity that even he could get out of step with. It very much is a feedback loop, a give and take between him and the supporters, which I think a lot of people who talk about it as like just a straight cult of personality kind of underestimate. But it's interesting to hear, in view of the transformation of the actual Republican Party that I've been documenting, it's interesting to hear how, you know, the party is still viewed as not on the team. And the party is still a punching bag for frustrations or an obstacle to the movement, even to the extent that the movement has come to occupy the literal party structure itself.
Well, this raises what I think is an essential point, which is we used to ask this question, are you a Trump Republican, right? Or are you a traditional Republican? And like that distinction used to make sense, but it doesn't make sense anymore, right? So like it's actually now sort of a silly question. And I have this theory. We were doing an episode in North Carolina about Mark Robinson, the gubernatorial candidate there, who's like a Holocaust-denying lunatic. And he's pulling behind Trump, although he's been actually gaining some steam recently. And I've actually been like, man, Trump is starting to sort of benefit from the absolute insanity of some of these other Republicans, where Trump now looks slightly more normal. And it's interesting you said feedback loop, because I talk a lot about something I'll call the Republican triangle of doom, which is the toxic and symbiotic relationship between the right-wing infotainment media, the elected officials, and the voters. And it is very much a self-radicalizing loop. And to the extent that, as this one guy was talking about in there, they now have these incentives toward likes and, you know, to be seen as a fighter, to be Trump-like. Like, Trump created those incentives. And yet Trump is still seen sort of as more moderate than the gremlins he created when he threw water on the Republican Party. There's not really a question in there. I guess that's an observation, but what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like, you know, Trump, the way that he totally transformed the conversation, redefined what the party stood for, and like the playbook of being a Republican politician post-2016, you know, by being such like a hard break with the political dynamics in the party before that, it creates room for like experimenting around the edges of the new dynamic that he created, which, yeah, in a weird way, like results in some people seeming further ahead than him.
Yeah, right. Like Carrie Lake and Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert and this guy, Mark Robinson, like they have a certain essence of Trump, right? You know, they call people names, they're super aggressive, they say the election was stolen, they live where the base is, but then they also, you know, just deny that the Holocaust happened, or have these really, really intense positions on abortion. And actually, one of the things I found super interesting about the Trump group was how many of them were like, when they talked about what they didn't like about the Republican Party, they were like, talked about it being too socially conservative, because they see Trump as much more of a social moderate. They mean like Trump's better on abortion and better on like gay stuff. They don't like love the trans stuff or whatever, but like they're kind of fine on gay marriage, and they are not interested in a Christian purist like Mike Pence. They want, you know, someone who's had three wives and sleeps with porn stars and like doesn't really have much of a moral compass on those types of things.
Yeah, that stuck out to me too. But I'm of two minds about it, because I think it's both true that we've seen that like Trump imitators have not been able to replicate his success. You know, like the stolen election myth hasn't really worked for anyone else. Like they're just losers. But at the same time, the way that the MAGA movement has taken up institutional residence in the Republican Party, I think does give it a durability that lives beyond Trump. So it's not as simple as like just being totally a cult of personality around Trump, whatever Trump says goes. But you know, it's like all on Trump's terms, but with a kind of durability at this point that it can actually go beyond just Trump himself.
You're right that like Trump, he's not always setting the direction. He's often following too, right? I think even in what he did in 2016, he understood where these voters were on things like immigration in a way that the Republican Party didn't. He understood where they were on, they didn't want to compromise with the left. He knew that if he went after the Republican Party and called them rhinos and cucks, that a big part of the party would react favorably toward that because they think the Republican Party sells them out by compromising with liberals. Anyway, I just think this is a very important point that you're raising, and really essential to understanding that people are like, well, it's all Trump or it's just the voters. And it's like, no, man, these things are working together like a symphony to create a new political order. And whenever I give a speech or something, I'm always like, none of you know who I am, so you're not going to remember me later. But like, if there's one thing I say that you're going to remember, I want you to remember this. There's no going back to the old Republican Party, because it'll save everybody time if everyone stops being like, well, how are we going to get it back to the roots of Reagan? Or how are we going to get Mitt Romney to be in charge of the party again? I'm like, it is not happening in the near term, because the fundamental thing that the Republican Party is doing, that it is like its voters, its media ecosystem, its elected officials, like it's a whole new thing. And the voters will tell you, we are not going back. They will articulate it clearly. We don't want that old thing.
Absolutely. But the flip side of this feedback loop or this like self-radicalizing bubble is how it's veering off from the experience of everyone else and, you know, getting more and more detached from the middle and the Democratic Party and stranding, I'm sure we're going to get to this in a minute, but stranding these traditional Republicans who are still Republicans, but are not MAGA and are totally at a loss for understanding. You know, they're asking the question that you're responding to of like, when is this going to snap back to normal?
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's get into that right now. So as I said at the top, one of the things I think Trump's trial kind of laid bare is the gap between what base voters demand and what the swing voters will tolerate. So let's listen to what base voters are demanding, starting with how they talked about the elected Republicans who showed up to support Trump during his trial.
I think it made it obvious who was pro-Trump and who was supportive of him, because it was only those few that are supportive that showed up. The rest of the rhinos did whatever they wanted. We got to keep in mind that the goal of a politician is to get reelected. That's their only goal. They want to keep that going because then they are privy to the knowledge that they're gaining on Capitol Hill and that income and what other bribes and things that they accept.
The fact that we don't have any pushback from our Republican governors, I mean, everything that's going on with Trump with the trials, maybe one governor out of 50 has come out that it made a statement about how this was unfairly being done to Trump, or the fact that we don't have any attorney generals going after the Biden family, none. We have none in any state on the Republican side going after any subpoenas or anything against any of them.
I would like to call out and congratulate the governor of Texas in the sense that once he started putting those illegals on buses and shipping them up north, it then became not just a California, Texas, Arizona problem with border crossings. It now became a national problem. He really had the fortitude, the courage to take the slings and arrows by doing that.
Now, I want to contrast those voters with a group we did right after the conviction of two-time Trump voters who were kind of out on Trump because of January 6th. And so they were already like, didn't want to vote for this guy again. But listen to how they talked about the elected Republicans showing up at Trump's trial and then some of these GOP types more broadly.
I think they've come off as lickspittles and toadies. I think they want to be vice president and they're sucking up to him. And it is embarrassing and they are embarrassing. I think the Republican Party has just destroyed itself. I think that Lindsey Graham was absolutely right 8 years ago when he said, we are going to get everything we deserve and we're going to deserve it. I'm sorry, I'm paraphrasing. I don't know. This is not Ronald Reagan. This is not the small government crew. I don't know who these people are, but I'm not interested in hanging with them.
In Ohio, J.D. Vance wrote a best-selling book called Hillbill Elegy. And in his book, he denounced Mr. Trump. And then he wanted to be senator, so he changed his mind. In my view, he sold his soul to get elected. And we recently had a primary for the opponent to Sherrod Brown, and all three of the Republican primary candidates were kissing up to Trump. They want to represent Mr. Trump. They don't necessarily care about the voters of Ohio. And I find that very unsettling, disturbing, and troubling. The Republican Party doesn't seem to have backbone courage of their convictions.
Nikki Haley, you know, she was not Trump this, not Trump that. I was giving her a little bit of benefit of the doubt that maybe, just maybe. And now all of a sudden she caves after he called her every name in the book.
The difference between our persuadable swing voters and our deep MAGA voters. In your reporting, like, did you see this contrast much, or tell me how it showed up in your reporting?
Well, I mean, what was amazing to me about those conversations, I mean, like, I think you called them swing voters, but like, these are two-time Trump voters.
That's right.
Like, these are Republicans. And the conversation was so interesting because when Megan was asking them about, you know, like, what was their breaking point? Like, what finally turned them against him? They did mention January 6th, but then they mentioned a lot of things that happened
before.
Like, they mentioned Access Hollywood, or they mentioned injecting bleach. And, you know, it was kind of like, all the things that they knew that made them uncomfortable that they were suppressing, and that, you know, once they had enough, it could all come out. You know, it was kind of freeing. So
wait, can we sit on this for 1 second? Because actually, I think you're onto something that's super important that people don't get. Okay, so I do use January 6th often as a stand-in for like the breaking point, but it is true that when you listen to voters talk who have voted for him twice but are out on him, they will often say things like, it's how he treats women. And you're like, well, he treated women real bad like the whole time. That's not like new information. And I think that what people have to understand about what January 6th did is it was like the permission to break for a certain kind of voter. And they always hated certain things about him. They held their nose and voted for him. And January 6th was the moment that they and probably other people around them were like, I'm done. I'm out. No more. And these are the people that are kind of holding that line because they never liked him much to begin with. Does that sound right to you?
Yes. And, you know, admitting you were wrong is so hard.
Yes.
It's like the hardest thing for a lot of people. And
that's why I never do it.
And so, you know, I think there's a way in which being able to look back at the things that you knew and that you recognized before is a comfort to that. Like you can level with the things that made you uncomfortable before, but it's a huge complicated combination of factors ultimately that goes into a vote.
Super true. Super true. One thing that caught my eye in your book was from the last governor's race in Virginia. So Steve Bannon and one of his other talk radio people, they were defending Glenn Youngkin when he did things like condemn the flying of the flag during January 6th at a campaign event in his honor. Bannon would like reassure his audience that Youngkin was really on their side. He was really one of them. And really believed that the election was stolen. And so Youngkin was able to sort of successfully walk this tightrope where he kept the MAGA crowd on side without alienating the moderates in Northern Virginia, which is like what you need to do basically to win in a lot of these swingier states. So for you, you know, we heard earlier that many in the base of the party are sick of the GOP losing all the time. But how much does the MAGA wing of the party care about hitting the balance between satisfying their base and actually winning elections? Like, what's the difference between what, say, Glenn Youngkin did and what many MAGA candidates did in 2022? And how did the MAGA crowd reckon with their candidates underperforming in 2022?
By believing that the elections weren't fair. I mean, right? Yeah. But, you know, I had an amazing conversation with Bannon right after the midterms, where he basically said, hell yes, it was the traditional Republicans who wouldn't accept these MAGA candidates, and they were the reason that we lost the midterms. But to Bannon, that's not a reason to moderate and try to win them back. He's saying to hell with them. He's saying we got to go out and find more MAGA voters. Bannon and the non-MAGA traditional Republicans agree that antagonizing the traditional Republicans who actually vote is the reason that Republicans have consistently underperformed in the Trump era. But I guess it's a difference of opinion on whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, because, you know, Bannon wants to just reinvent the entire Republican coalition rather than kind of tinkering around and getting to 50 plus one, you know, through the path of least resistance.
I'm so glad you're our guest today, because people do not understand what's happening right now, right? Like right now, everybody's like, why isn't Trump courting the Nikki Haley voters, right? Why is he saying permanently banned? That's bad politics, which I agree. It's bad politics. Politics is a game of addition, not subtraction. They do understand it. They just want different voters. They don't think that they can sustain the coalition of the college-educated suburban voters that used to make up the Republican Party. They are going to Black voters, Hispanic voters, more white working class voters, and they are trying to put together a multiracial working class coalition that hates establishment politicians, that wants to burn it all down, that is angry. And Bannon is saying, we're going to go get different people. Like, yes, that cost us this election, but our coalition that's coming together, we got to get rid of them anyway.
And by the way, like, that's not insane.
It's not
insane.
It could
work. I mean, ordinarily, you would view it as it is harder to like get infrequent voters to vote than to persuade persuadable, reliable voters. So there is a way in which they're reaching for the high-hanging fruit. But you have this really strange dynamic now for the first time in a while where the low propensity voter leans Trump instead of Biden. Historically, for the last several elections, the Democrats have been trying to expand the electorate with the view that that would result in more Democratic votes. And now, because you have this weird dynamic where the traditional non-MAGA Republicans who reliably vote are not inclined to vote for Trump, it's actually the Republicans who are out there trying to expand the electorate and register more voters and get people more engaged.
Which is why Democrats are doing so much better on special elections and midterms, because in the trade, they got high propensity voters, right? In this political realignment, they got a lot of these center-right voters. It's like in Wisconsin, you see a judge, Protasiewicz, where the abortion's the number one issue. She wins by, I forget, it was like 10 points in a place like Wisconsin. It's because in an off-year election, the people who vote in them are these very reliable center-right voters. But in a presidential, and this is where it's created a really hard time for sort of people in the political prognostication business to figure it out, because everyone's like, well, it's going to come down to turnout. But that's like truer than it's ever been, because nobody knows how many of these people are going for Trump. Like, they don't know how many new people he can produce and how many new people he's attracting into this coalition, because it's defying normal political compartments.
Yes. And also the idea of like suppression, and I don't mean like disenfranchisement suppression. I just mean like as a political tactic, like making the other side's base demoralized and not bother to turn out. I think that earlier on in the campaign, the Trump campaign was betting pretty big on that, that every 2020 Biden voter who didn't vote was a win for them. And I think it's more complicated now when you think about like a weird world in which a low turnout scenario actually benefits the Democrats.
Yeah, totally.
Because the more cynical voters are now skewing Republican.
Yes. Yeah. And look, I hear this all the time in the groups of the double haters, as we'll call them, right? Like, they're not going to vote for Biden, but they're not going to vote for Trump either. So it's like they have a diminished enthusiasm and they're kind of like, I'm either going to leave it blank or not vote. Or they get RFK curious. And you just hear a lot of that from that crowd. Okay, all right, so I can talk to you. But people are here for the people. They want to hear the people's voices. So I want to get into how the more MAGA voters talked about their hopes for Trump's second term. And there was plenty of what you'd expect from any of these kinds of voters. Like, they want to get inflation under control at the border. But there was also a lot of like hot stuff. And I mean that in a bad way. Let's listen.
I hope that it's a whole lot more robust in going after the swamp. This is his second term. He's not going to worry about re-election. I mean, I'm not saying it should be the Nuremberg trials, but it should be pretty damn close. I mean, people have to be gotten rid of. Other countries have not to be not trusted. He has to try to accomplish as much cleaning house as he possibly can in 4 years.
I'm hoping I see a purge in the government. He went in there so naively the first go around. And didn't get rid of a lot of top people like normal presidents do. And he got burned for it. And a lot of people like Mike Flynn got burned for it. So I hope that he purges from the top and says, you're fired, you're fired. Get him out of there. Because nobody's trustworthy in the swamp. I mean, I've lived in DC. I know what it's like.
Just hope he doesn't hold back. It's not like he has to worry about keeping people in the middle on his side for re-election. I hope he just gets in there and gets it done, makes most of his time. And whoever his VP is or other people in the party starts getting them ready to keep it going. Because you know, we all know he only gets two terms, so.
Super cute how people sort of think he only gets two terms or that he would deign to just do two terms. But, you know, you often see Trump saying things like, you know, I'm your retribution. And that gets people like this fired up. Like, they're like, yes. Like, he's the velociraptor that learned to work the doorknobs. Like, go get him, open the door, go eat some people. But then he kind of walks back that kind of rhetoric, or he acts like he's joking. And this is something you mentioned in your book, where he gets to like get away with sort of walking things back without appearing to cave when he plays these like word games, and he ebbs and he flows in his intensity. Like, talk about how he strategically positions himself to be all things to all people.
Well, what stood out to me is when Megan asked that same group if they wanted tit-for-tat retaliation, if they wanted Trump to get in and go after all his political opponents and throw them in jail, they actually said no. they actually said, like, I hope he would take the high road. Like, I hope he'd be better than that. Like, we need to move on. This is exhausting. So they are uncomfortable with it on a certain level. But when the question is framed just a little bit differently, and it's like, what should Trump do? And like, Trump says he wants to do this. Do you agree with that? Then, you know, there's a cue of like, yes, support the movement, support the leader. And, you know, he's deadly serious about it. He's saying he wants to do those things because he wants to do those things. And I get the feeling that a lot of his supporters are, you know, it's not their priority. But when you frame it as, you know, are you lining up behind him? Of course, the answer has to be yes.
Yeah. And, you know, you make a good point. And I sometimes have to defend voters on this count, which is that you're right when you say that they weren't eager to have him like locking up his political enemies. Although something not quite the Nuremberg trials was.
Yeah,
like,
that guy was the exception. That guy was all in.
That guy was being spicy. Yeah, that guy was wanted people hauled in front of, you know, whatever squads. But you're right that I do think Americans are not super comfortable with like outright prosecution. But this is where the locker up chance, it gets into the seriously, but not literally, where they sort of want to maintain the things that America's like not really supposed to do, like prosecute political enemies for nothing. But also they want to have a good time. And it's fun to talk about locking up your political opponents because people do not understand the red solo cup element to this, where it's just like, this is a good time talking about locking up our political enemies. Go ahead.
Well, so to answer the question you actually asked, the main tactics that he uses here are humor and rubber glue. Humor meaning, you know, like, I won't be a dictator except for day one, wink. Like, I'm joking, but actually I'm totally serious about the things that I want to be a dictator to do, quote unquote. And the other thing he does is, with the rubber glue trick, is I'm not a threat to democracy. Joe Biden's a threat to democracy. Joe Biden's prosecuting his political opponents, so I'd be totally entitled to. I don't want to, but he started it. And with both of these, what I've learned from interviewing experts in historical authoritarianism and just in political rhetoric, you know, the move is to desensitize voters. So, you know, you hear this word dictator, you hear words like Nuremberg, you hear that stuff enough and people just start to turn off to it. It numbs them to it. And then the other effect that it has is just to confuse voters about what the real danger is, and creating these false equivalencies leads to a more generalized cynicism of like, you know, they're both bad, this doesn't really matter. And that kind of attitude ultimately benefits the person who is trying to take down the democratic institutions.
Yeah. Like when I talk about the red solo cup phenomenon, I think there's a couple of things that get a little underappreciated about Trump. One is the extent to which he provides community for people. People love going to these rallies because it's like a great time. It's like seeing a concert. He just did this ridiculous one in Las Vegas where he said something like, I don't care about you. I just want your votes. And everybody starts roaring with laughter and it gets clipped and sent around like, see, he doesn't care about them, but they're missing how it's perceived in the room, which is people that are like, yeah, man, this guy is just all bombast. And like they don't care that he's not there for them. What they read from that is like, but like, we're all in this together and this is so fun and I'm here to cheer for this. And like, we're all going to buy t-shirts and drink beer and it's great. And then the other aspect is how much of the stuff that he says is mostly played for laughs and like lands with laughs. And so like, you're like, man, this is like super racist, this thing he just said. That is just not how it's being heard in the room, and not just by white voters. I do groups of black voters and play things that he said about, you know, black voters like me because I have a mugshot or whatever. And people will be like, yeah, man, the system's out to get him and they're just after him. Like they're after us. And like, that is how people read it. I think things land with people in such a different way than I think the media interprets the way they think it would land.
Yeah, the context matters a lot. And it is really hard to communicate appropriately because people understandably do find him so menacing and not funny, and he's not joking, but humor is so much a part of the experience and fun is so much a part of the experience and belonging, exactly like you said. I mean, it's cathartic in like an ancient Greek kind of way. You know, people come to be with other people and they laugh and they scream and they cheer and, you know, then they go home and are polite, you know, nice, regular people again.
That's right. And I'm going to quote Charlie Sykes for the second time in this podcast. One of the things he always said that I always thought helped capture this is like, a clown with a flamethrower still has a flamethrower. That's right. Like, Trump is deeply dangerous, but to his people, he does not read as dangerous, and which is why it's so hard to persuade on some of these things.
And just the humor also, it causes a lot of people to underestimate the danger.
I want to get into something that we hear concern about from all sides. Like, everybody's concerned about the prospect of like civil unrest and violence. You just hear it from all the voters. So obviously we know there's a certain segment of the MAGA movement that doesn't go quietly when it loses. But I was wondering how this segment of the Republicans thinks about this possibility. Like, these ones who are really in deep, how do they think about the potential of political violence? Let's listen.
I grew up in South Jersey, about an hour away from Wildwood. I've been there many, many times. And I know many people who went to the rally. And they were saying exactly what you were saying. It was very peaceful. It was just kind of like a nice party, you know, and they're supporting their candidate. Didn't have violence. The people picked up their trash, for God's sake. You know, it was just a lovely outing. It was wonderful.
It's going to come down to whether people do or don't feel that the election was fair or not. We know that the 2020 election was stolen. We've seen enough evidence to go and at least ask questions about it. But if they do what they did in 2020 again in 2024, and it's not done very subtly, then I can imagine the poor in this country will revolt. There won't be any violence. But if it's stolen again and it's blatant, I have a feeling that the poor are going to go in and not take another 4 years of this.
It really comes down to how the election plays out as well. If it ends up in Biden's favor and there are, you know, questions, like, for example, I remember, was it Fulton County? Also, they had to close down the voting center. Little suspicious. You see something like that again, I wouldn't be surprised if you saw people from the right start to fight back, because we've seen what's happened to Trump in New York.
Because the left are like petulant children. If they don't get their way, there's hell to pay, you know? And so we've observed that time and time again. Whereas, like, when Trump was recently convicted, where was everybody? You know, where was the right? Were they storming the gates and setting fires? No.
I think it's plain and simple that we have morals and we didn't get that participation trophy.
So one vignette from your book is about a woman from Georgia named Sally, who was a zealous poll watcher in 2020 and worked her way up within the party apparatus the last few years. And she went to a Stop the Steal rally on January 6th. And when she saw the riots on TV from her hotel room, it just didn't compute that that's something Trump supporters would do. And she was immediately posting on Facebook that the Capitol protest was fine until Antifa co-opted it and committed violence. So listening to those voters kind of be like, they are prepped and ready to say that the 2024 election is unfair. What do you think the MAGA effort to overturn the 2024 election might look like? And how do people inside the MAGA movement that you were talking to for the book, how do they think about violence? Because it seems like some of the people in this clip, right, they have like sort of a lust for the revolution, and but they're not going to take responsibility for it. It's the other side's fault.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what scares me about those clips is that, in contrast to the Trump to Biden voters and the two-time Trump voters who are drifting away from them, who spoke about the possibility of violence with a lot of fear and apprehension, I'm not hearing that from this group. It's very matter of fact, like, you know, that just might be how it has to be. And that starts from the top. That comes from Trump himself, who has said directly, we'll have to see how it goes. And then maybe violence is a possible response. So what happened in 2020 is that the misinformation about the pandemic and the George Floyd protests and the amount of violence in the George Floyd protests primed Trump supporters to reject the outcome of the election and then respond, you know, like when he said on January 6th, peacefully protest. That's a nudge wink because of, if you lived through that summer on Fox News, you know, those were quote unquote peaceful protests when they were being bombarded with images of fire and violence. And what's happening now, kind of repeating that, is that prep work is Trump talking about how the only way he could lose is if there's theft. And the RNC, now that Trump controls it, getting a head start on these legal challenges. So they're laying the groundwork now with a lot of cases that probably aren't going to go anywhere, maybe aren't even meant to get any legal outcome. But this isn't a mad dash after Election Day to try to overturn it. They're trying to seed those predicates now so that in the event that he loses, there's that much more plausibility.
Yeah, there's no doubt they are prepping for this. And, you know, it's not just Trump, right? Whenever you ask like a Marco Rubio or Tim Scott or anybody vying for the VP slot, you're like, will you accept the results of a 2024 election? You know, they get asked this by reporters all the time and they say, well, if it's free and fair. And then they're like, and Donald Trump's going to be the winner. And so it's basically like, yeah, they're prepared to not accept the results unless Donald Trump wins. It is, it's happening right here in plain sight. And from people who are like from Marco Rubio, you know? Anyway, okay. So you referenced this in your answer because there is a lot of concern in swing voters' minds about violence, no matter how the election turns out. So let's listen to how some recent Trump to Biden voters talked about it.
Seems like things have calmed down since Trump is out of office, but it still flares up. Mm-hmm. So definitely seeing it coming from the right, you know, still divided as a country, but not as divided as it will be or it was when Trump was president. It's a little dicey, especially with Trump and, you know, my kids and me and, you know, being Black in Arizona, it's a little different. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted anyone other than Trump. I was tired of, you know, watching over my shoulder and watching for my kids and stuff like that. So I figured, okay, Biden's my only choice. I don't care if it's a monkey. We're voting for the monkey.
For me, I'm in Metro Atlanta, which is like 13 counties that make up Atlanta, Metro Atlanta. So I have, you know, Democratic friends, Republican friends. And it was really hard because even during all of this, and even now, I hear them saying, you just wait, like there's some apocalyptic thing like right around the corner about to happen. And I've never heard that from friends that are more Democratic or more left. Even when there have been things that they're disapproving of, they just express themselves, but it's never that tone. So I'm not sure where they're getting that up, probably from some social media or something that they're reading, but there just feels like there's this low simmer going. And so it really does concern me greatly.
If Trump was convicted on all charges and he had to go to jail like the average person would, I think there'd be another riot in this country. I really do. You have so many crazy Trump supporters out there that would love just to start more stuff and have another riot somewhere. And I truly believe he's going to weasel his way out of it or they're going to do something to reduce the sentence and to prevent a riot.
So this is another just underappreciated aspect. I think sometimes people don't realize how much menace overhangs how voters think about this. Like they're worried about what Trump voters will do. What do you think Trump voters will do if Trump loses?
The thing that keeps me up at night is basically the, sorry for spoiler alert, season 4 of Succession, but the scenario where there's a disruption during voting or during counting that makes it impossible to recover the actual free and fair result is a much bigger problem than interference at the certification phase, which is what we saw in 2020. I think part of why that didn't happen in 2020 or 2022 is because of the confidence in MAGA that they were going to win. Looking at the current polling, you couldn't fault them for feeling the same way again this time. So maybe that's something putting the brakes on that. I mean, also, people often ask me why there hasn't been more violence around the indictments or the convictions. And the truth is that the January 6th prosecutions were successful in dismantling the organized violent extremist groups and in deterring people by making them think that there could be consequences or even more commonly that like any demonstration is a sting operation, is an FBI setup. And so that's been keeping people away. So that's a factor. I mean, the other thing that struck me from that clip, the woman in Metro Atlanta talking about what she hears from her friends is how much those conversations matter. And like, we as reporters don't often hear them, but I think that they really matter to voters a lot, is like the people they actually know in their communities and how just like regular old Trump supporters function as ambassadors for Trump and the movement. And that was something that I really tried to get at in the book, was like actually trying to capture some of those moments. And there's one traditional Republican in Arizona in particular who talks about like actually Trump's behavior bothers her, but it's the behavior that he brings out in his supporters that bothers her even more.
Yeah. Look, I hear this in the focus groups from the swing voters, often the Trump to Biden voters, who they know lots and lots of Trump voters. I remember I rewatched a focus group around January 6th. Like, we have now multiple January 6th groups, like anniversaries, but we were rewatching the ones from right after. And there was a woman there talking about how she worked in a warehouse with a bunch of guys who were MAGA guys, and they were like stockpiling weapons and things. And she just like knew about it and they talked about it. And I think that this is right, that there is, in these swingier places, and Metro Atlanta is like a really good example of this, where you encounter both. And you're like, actually, the behavior of these people I find more alarming than the behavior of these people. Like, you do get radicalized sometimes by the people you're around. And I mean, radicalized in opposition to them. Right. It's a great point. But I got to ask you on that point, this is sort of my last question, but it's a bigger one, which is, why isn't the MAGA movement sort of more of a liability? I do think that there are a lot of these college-educated suburban voters, and they don't want to be in a political coalition with Marjorie Taylor Greene. They're like, this isn't my party. But I sort of feel like the Wall Street Journal editorial page, there's still like plenty that are there and that don't seem to be driven away by sort of how dangerous, menacing the MAGA movement is. And I'm interested in why you think it's not. Like, why aren't more people driven away by this?
Well, I mean, the research suggests that most people are, right?
Yeah.
And the Democrats... this is also in the book, how the Democrats learned to love the word MAGA as an attack on Republicans because of its ability to drive a wedge between MAGA Republicans and persuadable moderate Republicans. You know, you taught me a lot about this too. So like empirically, there actually is a lot of evidence that MAGA is a huge political liability.
There is. I guess I'm just like, why isn't Joe Biden winning by 20 points out of the sheer like insanity of what's happening? Like, I guess for me, it's because I agree. Obviously, I do talk about this all the time. Like, at the margins, this is how you win. These are the people you need to persuade. But I am like, what is happening right now?
Yeah, well, I mean, haven't talked about like all of Biden's many political weaknesses, right?
I
mean,
so, like, those I get accused of spending too much time on that. So
yeah, I mean, so obviously that's a huge factor. You know, I talked to one guy last week who I called because he had told me last fall that he was a Trump-Biden voter and he was leaning toward Trump, but not if he was convicted. So after the conviction, I called him back and said, what about now? And he said, well, basically, I don't think that conviction was legit. It doesn't count. But
right,
based on other factors, he was totally undecided. He couldn't even give me an answer. He said he was looking for the debate. So, you know, we hear how the conviction can glom onto a sense of other things that are going on in voters' minds and push them over. But it's always like a huge swirl of lots of different things.
Yeah.
And there's no like single but for cause.
The big swirl, man. That is exactly right. It's a big swirl. It's a big swirl. I love that, Isaac. Isaac Arensdorf, thank you so much for joining us. And thanks to all of you for listening to the Focus Group podcast. Remember to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and subscribe to The Bulwark on YouTube. We will see you next week.